This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, we're going to get evil with the Minions and the Gallows and possibly Selfless. And I'm also going to be talking about Amy, the new documentary, and Stung, a comedy horror film. I'll also have news, the trailer park, box office prediction, and the world famous DVD roundup, plus an interview with James Guy Rees, who is the producer of Amy. So that's all coming later in the show. But first, this is how you can get in touch with me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. First, a sad piece of news. Amanda Peterson, who most people will recognize from Can't Buy Me Love, the movie with Patrick Dempsey from the 80s, she passed away last week at 43 years old. Her body was found on July 3rd, and it's still to be determined what the cause of death is. They're doing an autopsy. I mean, when you die at 43 years old, it's a surprise. I mean, it's not unheard of, but it's not the normal way of things. Peterson dropped out of the public eye in the mid-90s and really kind of nobody knew where she was and nobody had followed up with her because she did Can't Buy Me Love and she was in Explorers and she was in a couple TV shows. And then she dropped out. No one knew what happened to her afterwards. It's not like she was in the witness protection program. It's just she was keeping a low profile. Well, since her passing, People Magazine has dug into her past and found like 4 arrests, 1 DUI and some drug paraphernalia charges, and she spent like 3 months in jail. So there were some problems going on there. Now, her parents have said that there's no drug connection to her death, yet they said that she had sleep apnea, and that could have contributed to it. To me, that sounds a little odd, because sleep apnea is not something that directly kills people. It's a condition that can exacerbate a lot of things and can put you in your body on stress, but nobody like, I don't even know of any cases of people dying of sleep apnea specifically. I think maybe Andre the Giant, but I mean, he had a lot of other issues with him. All the stuff's still coming out. You never know. And I'm not speaking ill of the dead, but I would not be surprised if there was, you know, something like what happened with Heath Ledger or even Michael Jackson, where these were prescription, legally gotten pharmaceuticals for a condition. And then whatever her other conditions were exacerbated. Because that could happen, you know, you can take a tranquilizer, and if you already have sleep apnea, especially if it's severe, you could choke to death in your sleep if you've suppressed the rest of your system as well. We'll see what happens. It's sad to see this happen to anybody, and it's been 20 years since she's been in the public eye. That's sad news. The next piece of news that came out this week, this sort of preceded all the Comic-Con coverage. I'm not going to cover Comic-Con news this week, mainly because so much happens at Comic-Con, and Comic-Con is such a circus. I'm not there because I can't handle that many people in one small place. There's going to be news from everything from Doctor Who to Star Wars to Marvel to DC. That's all going to be splattering through the internet through the whole weekend. Generally, there aren't a whole lot of big announcements made on Sunday, but by the end of the weekend, I'll finally be able to sort through that. But I'm not going to talk about those now. One of them that did precede the Comic-Con news was Chris Miller and Phil Lord. They're the people who did the Lego movie most famously, and they also did 21 Jump Street. They've been tapped to direct the Han Solo Star Wars anthology telling the story of young Han Solo. Now, this is rubbing some people the wrong way because they don't think we need more on Han Solo. But, you know, the extended universe stuff, the books and the comics and the games have been dealing with this stuff for years. And while this is no longer canon to the series that Disney's running, it shows that there's still a market for that. And there's nothing wrong with that, as long as it's done well. And I'm curious because these guys are mostly known for comedy or tongue-in-cheek work, but it all really depends on casting. If they cast somebody good. Now, if they go and cast somebody like Jai Courtney because he's been in a bunch of big films, it's going to be freaking terrible. Or if they do some sort of stunt casting and try to cast outside of the box and bring in Justin Bieber, That's also going to be a disaster. It all depends on casting at this point for this movie. I mean, yes, script and story and character and all that kind of stuff. But that's where it really hinges upon who ends up being the new Han Solo as a young guy. Another piece of news is Marissa Tomei has been tapped or rumored to be ready to sign to play Aunt May in the new Spider-Man series. Essentially, you're getting a hotter and hotter Aunt May. I mean, you started off with the woman who played Aunt May in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man. She was like 85 years old. And then you had Sally Field, who's old, but she was really cute when she was younger. And now you've got Marissa Tomei, who's like 50. So first of all, this is going to be the first Aunt May that a lot of people are just going to want to bang anyways. But I think that's cool. They're starting young because I think they're looking ahead because they are at least hoping this Spider-Man incarnation will last 10 or more years. So they don't want to cast somebody who's going to die in a couple of years. You know, they don't want to cast somebody who's like 85 because, you know, who knows. And then the final piece of news for big fans of The Simpsons, Harry Shearer has signed back on to do his voices in seasons 27 and 28. Now, we all knew that this was going to be a big contract negotiation. That's not a surprise. Let this sink in, though. The Simpsons are signing people for seasons 27 and 28. We're in Lawrence Welk territory with how long this show has been going on. And yeah, you have shows like 60 Minutes, but that's a news magazine program. And yeah, you've got stuff like, you know, The Tonight Show that's been on. But these are sustainable shows that don't worry about plot and writing necessarily. You've got essentially a sitcom that's pushing three decades, which is amazing. I haven't watched Simpsons in a long time, since like the 80s or 90s. But that's kind of just a fascinating thing in itself. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first film I want to talk about is Goosebumps, starring Jack Black as R.L. Stine, as a version of R.L. Stine. It's taking the approach to the Goosebumps as if the Goosebumps books are real, and R.L. Stine has a secret about them. But here's the trailer.
Hi. Hey, we're just moving in.
You see that fence?
Yes.
Stay on your side of it.
He's a big teddy bear.
Don't take it personally. He doesn't really like anyone.
Yeah.
Oh, the Abominable Snowman of Pasadena? These are all Goosebumps manuscripts. Why are these books locked?
Did you unlock a book?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I'll put it back where it belongs. Look, here it is.
No, don't open it!
This opens on October 16th, which is great. This is like the perfect time to open a Goosebumps movie. I think that Sony might have an opportunity to do some pretty cool stuff because they've got this, they've got Pixels, they've kind of tanked a bunch of things recently, and the Sony hack last year was devastating to them. But they might be rebuilding on the kids format because they got Pixels coming up, and Pixels, for as much crap as Adam Sandler gets, Pixels is getting a lot of play, and all the kids want to see it. And I have to admit, I kind of want to see it. So if Pixels does any good, if you can look past your disdain for Adam Sandler, and Goosebumps works, I think Goosebumps look like it can be fun. I'm looking forward to it a little bit. I'll check it out in Halloween time. The next one, I'm just going to play it because it just has to be heard to be believed.
There's something in that bay, Nita!
Tell me about that creature you saw.
It was a shark. The big one with tentacles, maybe.
What is it?
Lurch octopus? Dude, seriously, you don't have internet? The thing has a Twitter account.
He already followed me back.
Sharktopus and werewolf are destroying the city.
Did you just say werewolf?
That's right. Sharktopus versus werewolf. This is another Sci-Fi Channel movie. They've made quite a name for themselves making really terrible monster movies. And this is not the first Sharktopus sequel. I think they did Sharktopus versus Python Piranha or something. They did something. But the idea of a whale wolf and the Sharktopus is running around town, it's like running through a mall, is kind of amazing. It's sad because I remember when the Sci-Fi Channel started, like back in the 90s, it was like really trying to be on the cutting edge and doing innovative sci-fi stuff. And while they have some cool stuff on there, I mean, they've got Continuum and they did the Stargates and they had BSG and they had some really cool stuff, but they've rebranded it a little bit. And they've just had such success with the crap, with the Asylum stuff, which I love Asylum stuff, but they have such success with Sharktopus and Sharknado. So this is sort of turning into a joke. This is turning into what the Learning Channel is for learning, which is not about learning anymore. It's sort of the Lecture Channel. The sci-fi is more like crappy sci-fi. But there's something appealing about Sharktopus versus Whale Wolf, which airs on July 19th. Search Twitter. I'm sure people will be talking about it there. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Selfless and Stung. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies coming back to the show to start the movie reviews. Let's start off with Selfless. This one stars Ryan Reynolds and Ben Kingsley. And in the film, a wealthy old man hires a service to transfer his consciousness to a younger body, only to find himself asking ethical questions about the process.
You've built an empire from the ground up. People will insist that your buildings make you immortal. Now, as you slip away, do you feel immortal? We offer humanity's greatest minds more time to fulfill their potential. Designed to offer you the very best of the human experience.
It's alive.
An empty vessel.
If we do this, there's no turning back. Your old life is over.
This is directed by Tarsem Singh, who did movies like Immortals, and I believe he did The Cell, oh gosh, 20 years ago, something like that. This is a very visionary director, and as visionary as he usually is, this one's kind of low-key. And I don't know why. I don't know whether he's just getting less crazy in his old age, or if he's really trying to restrain himself. There are some fascinating concepts with Selfless, and it deals with consciousness and the soul and humanity and ethical and medical decisions. And it feels like sort of this outlier science fiction. It doesn't feel like a movie that should be coming out in July as a big summer movie. It feels like it probably would have been more realistic to throw it into September or October, or maybe into March or April as sort of a smaller release, which often can get buried, but this is probably going to get, it's getting buried this weekend anyways, because you got Minions, and you've got The Gallows, which is pulling a little more buzz, and also Amy, which is really getting a lot of buzz. So it's kind of lost out there. In a way, reminds me of Transcendence, the Johnny Depp movie about artificial intelligence and mapping his brain to a computer. Selfless has some interesting concepts, but it really never knows how to examine them. It has a great setup, but I'd say about a third of the way into the movie, when it gets to sort of be that second act, if you want to talk three-act structure, it just gets really dumb. The movie gives up on being smart. And it then just turns into a couple people on the run kind of movie, being chased by bad guys in SUVs. Which is, I mean, that's passable for a Hollywood movie, but for some of the great concepts that were teased in the beginning of the film, it just seems sort of cheap by the time it gets to the second act, and then never really recovers. But still, I wasn't unentertained by the movie. It runs a little long. It's pushing 2 hours, and for the depth of the story, does not deserve a two-hour movie. It might have felt a little better if it was an hour and a half. I mean, I wasn't bored. I wasn't checking my watch. I wasn't ready to get out of there, which happens a lot in movies if they're not executed properly. It's fine disposable science fiction. It's the kind of thing you could swerve into on a lazy Saturday on HBO or hit it on Netflix in a couple years and be like, I never saw this. Let me watch it. And it filled the time. But I guess, you know, Hollywood doesn't want to make movies just to fill the time. They want the big blockbusters. I think this also got a little botched in the release because it was always touted as a focus feature movie. And they did some real interesting early marketing. They actually sent me a phone that was sending me text messages about if I were to swap my body, or called shedding your body is what they call it in the movie. So they had some really cool things surrounding this. And then it just sort of disappeared. And the marketing and the push of this movie feels a lot like the movie itself, where it had some great ideas and some great attempts at doing something. And then as it just got about halfway through, it just sort of like, well, we're just going to forget about it. But it's not a terrible movie. Just don't expect anything deep or significant from it. And it has some really dumb things in it as well. But I like the people involved. I mean, I think Ryan Reynolds does a good job. It's him doing straight. I don't like it when he just is always trying to be funny in his movies. I like him to play straight roles now and then. And Matthew Good's in it. He does a fine job. And Ben Kingsley's in it for a little bit because he's the old man. And when he loses his body, you know, of course, the Ben Kingsley part, they chuck him. I don't know. I guess on the whole, as an overall high-level view, I still have to say this kind of sucks because it's not quite what it really could be. So Selfless kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Stung. This is a smaller movie from IFC Midnight, their Midnight series, which is a series of horror movies. A swanky outdoor dinner party is interrupted by a swarm of gigantic killer wasps.
Did you see that? There are these massive wasps flying around here. You should be careful.
Ow!
They're like this. They're huge. Avoid everything here. It's bad.
Oh, poor baby.
Help! I think something's bit it.
Get inside right now!
Now, this one actually opened, I think, theatrically last week, but it's in a very small rollout. It's in my local town, Columbus, Ohio, at the Gateway Film Center, so you can catch it on the big screen. And this actually is pretty competently put together for just a big, dumb monster movie. That's really all. It's a monster movie. It's bugs. And we've seen these movies before, and we've seen good ones like Slither, which is essentially a bug movie. And we've seen terrible movies like Eight-Legged Freaks. This one works. I mean, it's definitely low budget. I think it's shot in Germany, but they do a lot more with the special effects. Yeah, sure, it's a little bit low-level CGI, and you've got some animatronic wasps and bugs that look a little silly. But they're very forgivable in the context, and they actually do some really cool stuff with it for the bigger, more destructive wasps in it. Not deep story, but, hey, you're in a world where Sharktopus versus whale wolf exists. So Stung already is on a pedestal much higher than the crap that's thrown onto Sci-Fi Channel every Saturday night. Like you'd expect, there's not much of a story, and it's very typical, and it's very cliche at times. But the movie, it runs like 80 minutes long, less than, I think, when you actually don't take into account credits. So it's quick. It's in and out. And they got some interesting names in it. They've got Clifton Collins Jr. He's in it. You've also got Lance Hendrickson, who's getting old. But, you know, it's kind of neat to see these familiar faces. Direct-to-video type of stuff. This is for horror fans. It's unrated, so it definitely has the gore. And it doesn't start out with the gore. That's kind of neat that it doesn't start out with gore from beginning to end. But it definitely delivers on the gore and the violence and the goo and the gross moments, because when the wasps attack, you definitely have some fun with it on screen. So, if you like monster movies, if you like the modern monster movies, which is, there's this new brand of direct-to-video and VOD and very limited theatrical release horror movies that are getting a resurgence now. And I'm glad to see it sort of taking itself a little seriously. It still has delivered a lot of its tongue-in-cheek, and I've seen description of this movie range from comedy horror to romantic horror, which I don't quite get that last one. I mean, there's a bit of a love story in there, but it does not, you don't say, oh, I need a sweet romance. Let's watch Stung, where on the poster, there's this woman about to get stung in the eye by a wasp. I mean, that doesn't exactly scream sweet rom-com date night movie, unless you're really awesome. And then, yeah, do it as a date night. But ultimately, Stung is fun. It's campy horror movie fun. So I'm going to have to say Stung kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Minions and the Gallows. There's There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's keep going through the movie reviews. The big one of the weekend, the one that I think most people are talking about, is Minions. It's not a sequel to the Despicable Me films. I guess you can say it's a prequel because it takes place before it. But it's really more of an offshoot. It's a spinoff. And in Minions, long before they ever meet Gru, the Minions search the Earth for the most evil boss to serve. This story finds them in London in the 1960s as they try to steal the crown jewels and take over England for an evil villainess.
You're going to VillainCon, aren't you?
VillainCon! I'm going to get all my favorite villains to sign my magazine. Scarlet Overkill! If I was a minion, that's who I'd want to work for.
Ladies and gentlemen, the supervillain we've all been waiting for,
and all your dreams come true. Respect. Power.
Banana.
Banana.
I've said for a long time that I would love to see some of these supporting characters get their own movies, and they tried it last year with The Penguins of Madagascar, which I thought was kind of cute, actually. I liked The Penguins of Madagascar. I felt bad that it did so poorly, especially considering the Madagascar movies haven't been all that great. I mean, they've been entertaining, but they really have forced themselves to try to do something with all the characters in every single movie. Madagascar doesn't hold up as much as, like, say, Toy Story does. But I love some of these supporting characters. I like the Penguins of Madagascar. I love the Minions. I always said that if they did an Ice Age movie that was just all about Scrat, the little saber-toothed squirrel, I'd watch the heck out of that movie. I love that kind of stuff. And I think the Minions work. The Minions are insanely popular. This is a very cute movie. It is not deep. It is not meant to bring tears to your eyes. It's not even meant to be as touching as, say, the original Despicable Me was, or any of the Toy Story movies, or pretty much anything from Pixar. It's not meant to make you cry. And that's okay. I don't think you should. The Minions are a vehicle for comic relief, and the Minions are slapsticky Three Stooges, in the point that they actually have kind of the Three Stooges in here. They've got Kevin, Stewart, and Bob. And one of them's kind of the leader, and one of them's the goofball, that's Bob, and one of them is sort of the wild card, and that's Stuart. It's a cute movie. It is exactly what you should expect. And in fact, the only time it really kind of gets in the way, they have Sandra Bullock play Scarlet Overkill, who's their new leader before they ever meet Gru. And I like Sandra Bullock. I just think she's sort of bland in this movie. The character, there's not much to the character. There's actually more to the character's husband, played by John Hamm, who has a little more to do in terms of just being silly. But you have to look at this as a tiny, rubbery, yellow version of the Three Stooges. That's really what they are, and it's cute. It's very worthy of the Despicable Me name, and it fits well into everything. It's not perfect writing, but considering you have the main characters who don't speak much English at all, it's sort of like WALL-E in that respect. Whereas WALL-E, I remember I had an interview with Andrew Stanton at Comic-Con several years ago, before WALL-E came out. And it was a round table, and there's one guy asked Andrew Stanton, you know, what was it like making a movie with a main character that doesn't talk? And Stanton looks the guy in the face and is like, WALL-E talks. He talks all the time. He just doesn't speak English. And that's the essence of the Minions as well. The Minions speak Minionese. And you can guess by context and some of the fake words that they say what they're saying, but really, honestly, it's they're these jabbering idiots, but they're adorable and they're wonderful. And in fact, even though I didn't like Despicable Me 2 as much as I liked the first Despicable Me, I thought the Minions are what made that movie work. So I have to say that the Minions is it's not perfect. It's not as good as the first Despicable Me. But it certainly is a lot of fun, and it will appease everybody who likes the Minions. The kids are going to like it. The adults are going to like it. The Minions, I've met few people who are sour on those characters. So this is a big summer movie. The biggest struggle it's going to have is it's going up against Inside Out in the box office. And Inside Out, that's a tough contender. But still, I'm going to have to say that Minions kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is The Gallows. Several high school students try to disrupt the production of their school play, only to discover the theater is haunted by the violent ghosts of someone who died during the production 20 years ago.
Yeah, this place is super creepy at night.
All right, here's the stage. Let's do what we came here for.
Who the hell would be in here right now?
Hello?
Senior Charlie Grimm will die after a prop malfunction during the high school's presentation of The Gallows.
What's going on?
There's no tape in here.
Someone died in the school?
I feel like a broken record when I talk about stuff like this. Anyone who knows me or has listened to me or read my reviews, they know I don't like found footage. And it's not that I think it's a worthless medium. It's that it has a very limited use. And something like the original Paranormal Activity really worked. I think Cloverfield worked. But the idea of just saying we want to do a horror movie, well, we need to give it a modern spin. Let's make it found footage. And I think I said this before. That reminds me of when I was a kid in music class in school in the 80s. And there were people who were saying, well, we thought we'd try something different and new. Let's do a rap. And then you'd have your dorky suburban music teacher trying to rap, which is not a rap at all. It's like sort of spoken verse. And it is the worst. And it was so embarrassing to watch that happen when I was a kid. And that's what I feel these found footage movies are. They have this idea for a movie and they say, well, we got to make it cheap. So let's do found footage. I mean, look at The Gallows. The Gallows had a budget of probably about $58. It was not very expensive, but I don't think it would have been that expensive if they shot it traditionally. I refuse to believe that the found footage is what brought the budget down. The reason it was cheap to make is because practically the entire thing takes place in a school and 80% of the movie is just four kids running around an empty, dark school building. This movie reminds me a lot of the film As Above, So Below that came out last year. That's the one about the catacombs under France. And the reason it reminds me of that is because I thought As Above, So Below had some really neat stuff in it. It had some great concepts. It had some great material, had some great ideas that needed to be fully explored, but they just were squandered in order to fit in the found footage context. And the problem with found footage is, by its own design, it doesn't explain anything. It's just, it's an observant type of medium. No explanation is required. And that's just lazy. And there's so much in this film that I was watching. I even sat out, came out, and I was talking to some people I knew who had seen it. And I was like, who was this person? This thing happened, and you totally expect something happened at one point. I can't say what it is, but there was this mysterious thing that actually looked really cool, and I'm like waiting for them to revisit it. They didn't. What was that? What did that mean? I don't know. Who was that? I don't know. Because that's not the way found footage works. Found footage is just jump scares and startling, and it's like a kid on a playground with other friends, and they're going, let's play dungeon. Okay, now let's say I'm the dungeon master. And then somebody's like, okay, let's say I'm a wizard now, and I can do this. And you're like, wait, how are you a wizard? No, we don't explain that. We just are, because we're 6 years old, and we're on the playground, and we're just making crap up in our heads. And that's what this movie feels like. There's a whole bunch of stuff that needed to be explained. Like, there's the whole setup is there. All the kids in the school are required to take this drama class and put on a play that takes place after us. I'm like, why would they ever require that? I understand if it were an elective and saying, well, we're going to put on this play, but they're requiring the football players to go on, and the football players are all D-bags to everybody, and the guy who's filming everything is like the biggest jerk on the planet. And I get the whole point is so we can kind of see him get his comeuppance if the ghost goes gets him, but They overdo it. And then, of course, like any found footage movie, the first half of it is just inane, stupid dialogue, hemming and hawing, overacting, over-talking. It's terrible. And then when stuff finally happens, there's some really neat imagery. Yeah, it looks really cool. There's some really cool imagery. There's some neat things that happen. There's some very genuinely creepy moments. But it doesn't hold together. What could be really impactful is just a fleeting thing. There's no explanation given for anything that is even necessary. You don't have to explain everything and dumb it down to the audience, but you at least have to make it coherent and have a certain internal logic. You can't go into a haunted house and suddenly have a clown show up and go, blah, 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 I'm an evil clown, and then never address it. They don't do that, but it's essentially they do things like that. So what could have been a really neat movie and had some really neat ideas in it, it just doesn't work. And then when you think about how it all supposedly fits together, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Kind of like The Devil Inside. Made no sense. It's really depressing because what could have been a good movie isn't. So I'm going to have to say The Gallows sucks.
It sucks.
With that, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be reviewing Amy and also talking to James Guy Reese, who is the producer of the film, and also be talking about box office and the world-famous DVD roundup. Because we can, can! Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to roll right into the last film, which is Amy. The tumultuous life of jazz singer Amy Winehouse is examined in this new documentary.
She was highly intelligent, the most intelligent person I knew.
She had such an emotional relationship to music.
You're becoming an artist in the public eye.
The more people see of me, the more they'll realize that all I'm good for is making music.
Amy was a girl that just wanted to be loved.
I never listened to Amy Winehouse before, right before her death. I she had become such a train wreck in the American media that I finally looked her up. Because she looks nothing like what her music sounds like. She was this lusty, throaty jazz singer, and she looks like she belongs in a punk band. And that was sort of an enigma. But then she died like that soon after I looked her up because she was in the middle of the train wreck. And so most of my knowledge of Amy Winehouse is all posthumous for her. So I didn't follow her career. I'm not a fan of her music. And so I never really listened to her. So this was an interesting approach to this because it showed what her life and trajectory was. So it was new. It was new stuff to me. I didn't know. And in that sense, I found it somewhat fascinating. It fits together better than some music documentaries because some of these can run really long. But there really was a definite purpose and pacing and delivery to Amy that worked as a film. And one of the things they do is she's so throaty and so heavy and lusty in her singing that sometimes you can't understand what the lyrics are. And they throw the lyrics on screen as she's singing them, which is kind of very helpful. But they do it in a very artistic way so it doesn't feel like it's just subcaptioned. But it does show what a mess she was. And I'm coming from a very non-judgmental standpoint because I have no interest one way or the other in Amy Winehouse's career. But it does show that she was an absolute train wreck. And she was a train wreck from the beginning. Because one of the reasons she says in one of the archive footage, or her friend said, that she just wanted to move out of her parents' flat so she could get her own so she could smoke pot all day. And I'm like, well, you know, if that's your goal at 19, and that's your goal, not I want to move out because I want some freedom and I want to do what I want to do or I want to come home late and I don't have to clean my room or whatever. If your goal is to move out so you can smoke pot, you are probably going to have problems with drugs later on in your life. It really shows the problems that she had and a lot of the wounds were self-inflicted and very tragic for her. Very different than most music documentaries. Very similar in many ways because you get performances and that sort of thing. But it's not a bunch of talking heads. And it's relatively recent for such a short life that it has a complete feel to it, which is always dangerous when you're doing a documentary, having that complete feel. And her life did steamroll ahead towards her death. So there is a dramatic arc to it. So I'm going to have to say Amy kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
I also had a chance to interview James Guy Reese, who was the producer on Amy. If you want to hear the full interview, you can go to fatguysatthemovies.com and find it there. It's like 15 minutes. But here's the truncated interview. I just wanted to play this here for everybody.
How did you first get involved with the movie?
I was approached by a guy called David Joseph, who's the chairman of Universal Music in the UK. He's a friend of a friend of mine, and he'd been a big fan of a previous movie we'd made called Senna, about the Brazilian racing driver. I was editing a romantic comedy, believe it or not, in an editing suite in Soho in central London, and I got a text from David Joseph out of the blue saying, would you ever consider making a documentary about Amy Winehouse in the same vein as Senna? And without even really thinking about it, I said yes straight away.
Were you a fan of Amy Winehouse before you were approached?
You know what, I wasn't a massive fan. I mean, I sort of was aware of the talent, but you know, I think that the horrible tabloidy story kind of just drove, I'm so not a fan of that world, I just can't bear all that stuff. And I think it sort of drove me away from the story, really. And so it's been an amazing process of discovery since then.
There's so much candid video. How did you get access to all of that, especially the earlier stuff in her life?
Some of it we got from the family. Some of it we got from her friends. And that was the difficult bit, to be honest with you, because a lot of her really good friends had taken sort of a vow of silence after she died, not to speak to the media in any way, shape, or form because of the experiences she was having with the media before she died. And then we had to sort of convince them that we were going to make the right sort of movie because they were very, very skeptical. And it was just a war of attrition. We just kind of, you know, we charmingly badgered these people for about 2 years in some cases until they finally came through. And then they would say, okay, I'll help you, but then I don't want to sign a release until I've seen the finished movie, which is the first rule of documentary making. You never do that. But we had to take that leap of faith with people because there was no way they were going to play ball otherwise. But now they're all really pleased they did it.
You got some stuff from the family, but especially at the end, the dad, her father, isn't painted in the best light. I mean, by just sort of the facts of the case. Was there any problem there with sort of how he was presented as possibly an enabler?
No, I don't think so. I think he did the best under very difficult circumstances. I mean, I think a lot of people were out of their depth because you're dealing with a very, very complicated situation. But I think, listen, you know, a lot of us have been touched by addiction, and I think a lot of us are out of our depth when it comes to dealing with it. It's a very, very complicated issue. Very difficult. We're trying not to be judgmental in the movie at all. We're trying to present the facts as we saw them from, you know, a very exhaustive research process.
One of the things I liked, and this is because I haven't listened to much of her music, and as unique and as talented as she was, it wasn't always easy to understand what she said, but you put the lyrics on screen. Did it feel like it was dumbing it down for the audience, for somebody like me who doesn't know the lyrics?
No, I think it's the opposite. I mean, I think it's a gift, really, because when we were basically trying to identify what the movie was and what we were trying to say with the movie, we suddenly realized that the story was all in her song. She was writing from the heart about her life as it happened. So we had this incredible gift for you whereby we could show what she was singing about while we saw the lyrics basically express it. Do you know what I mean? So it was an incredible way to juxtapose the audio and the visual.
Do you feel that sort of her life trajectory, was this an inevitable thing? Was she a self-destructive personality, or was this going to happen regardless of where she went in her career, or was she a victim of circumstance?
I don't know, that's a good question. I mean, she was definitely very self-destructive, there's no doubt about it. I think fame came too quickly for her. She'd never had time to recalibrate and grow up and calm down, you know, because it happened so early for her. I think the problem is she knew that if she got really big, she was going to run into problems. I don't therefore mean that she knew she was going to die, but I think she knew she was going to get, you know, she was going to struggle with it.
The story of Amy Winehouse, an interesting story and a sad story and a tragic story. Definitely worth checking out in the cinemas. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office and what happened last week. I was wrong. That happens now and then. I'm allowed a couple of those mistakes now and then. I mean, talk about horse race. It was a horse race between Inside Out, Jurassic World, and Terminator Genesis. The winner ended up being, even though I said Terminator Genesis would, the winner ended up being Inside Out. Inside Out beat Jurassic World by just over $500,000 over the three-day weekend for the 4th of July. At $29.8 million, and Jurassic World made $29.2.5 million. Terminator Genesis did okay with $27 million, and ultimately $42 million from when it opened through the weekend, because it opened on Wednesday. Magic Mike sunk like a stone, as I predicted, once it got through those first couple days and all the women went to go see it. It had like 96% of the audience was female. So it was one of the most weighted demographics going into the weekend. And Magic Mike's going to continue to sink. Now, it made money because the movie, I think, cost like $15 million to make. So it's ultimately profitable. And even though Terminator Genesis is going to at least well double Magic Mike's take, Terminator Genesis is still struggling. I think the biggest problem is that it was just Terminator Genesis was a little bit too convoluted. It was trying to do too much. And to understand the movie, you actually needed to understand all the time looping and bumping back and forth, which I think the general mainstream audience isn't into watching that. This is the audience that was confused by Inception, which is not confusing at all. I mean, Inception is incredibly straightforward. Yet people are like, I can't wrap my brain around Inception. It's so confusing. No, it's not. Dream within a dream, within a dream. Boom, there you go. That's Inception. Terminator Genesis, a little more complicated. It hasn't been a great banner year for Paramount right now with releases because they had Hot Tub Time Machine 2, which kind of bombed. Everything's hinging now on Mission Impossible 5 later this summer. This week, Minions is going to win, no doubt about it. Its tracking is just under $100 million, although I'm just going to say safely $85 million for the weekend, simply because that $100 million mark is amazing. And Universal is making so much money this year with Jurassic World and Furious 7. This movie could make $5 in the theaters, and they're still going to do well. You're listening to Fat Guys and the Movies with Kevin Carr. Really, finally, quickly, I'm going to talk about the world-famous DVD roundup. We've got a couple ones to hit. We've got Maggie, which is the Arnold Schwarzenegger zombie drama, which is okay. It's interesting because Schwarzenegger's playing so off-type in it. But that's worth checking out. It's a little dull and doesn't have a lot of oomph to it, but it's interesting to see for Schwarzenegger's turn in acting. Woman in Gold, which stars Ryan Reynolds and Helen Mirren trying to get a painting back for somebody who lost it during World War II. There's also Kill Me Three Times with Simon Pegg, a somewhat funny, different movie about assassinations. House of Cards Season 3, the Netflix series. Joe Dirt has come out on Blu-ray in anticipation for the Joe Dirt 2 sequel that everybody's looking forward to, sure to win an Oscar. And then Playing House Season 1, the USA show about motherhood and babies and best friends. And with that, I need to go to a break. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Marvel's Ant-Man and Trainwreck. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.